Kelly Sandoval here calling our Policy Advisory Committee meeting of June 13th to order. And I'd like to welcome you all, and I am assured that you've read the minutes from our last meeting of May 9th. So I would... there's a motion and a second. Any discussion? All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of passing the minutes from May?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? That passes unanimously. While I don't have any public comment cards at my desk at this item, I don't know if there's any members of the public wanting to speak to an item not on the agenda. Not seeing anybody wildly or even mildly waving their hands, we're going to go on to the next item. And I understand there was no Equity and Access Subcommittee meeting today, so I believe there's no report to make. Okay, great. Thank you, Richard. And so our next item of business, item number 5, is nominations for the 2012-13 Policy Advisory Council Chair and Vice Chair. Rich Hedges?
Can you tell me who we're nominating first chair?
First chair. And Pam's going to take the list, but would you turn your mic on? Thank you.
You're welcome. I would like to nominate Dolly Sandoval for chair.
Thank you. Are there any
second.
Okay, and seconded by Marshall. Are there any other nominations for chair at this time? Okay, I will ask that the nominations for chair be open until the beginning of our next meeting in July. And so if somebody would like to nominate somebody else, you can contact Pam Grove through email. I'd like to take nominations then for vice chair. Boy, this is a race.
I think she beat us.
Dolores?
Yes, I'd like to nominate Linda Jeffrey-Saylors.
Okay.
For vice chair.
Nomination for Linda Jeffrey-Saylor for vice chair.
And I'd like to nominate Egon.
And Rich would like to nominate Egon. And Marshall?
I'll second that.
Okay, you'll second. I'm not sure we need. I think we can just enter these into...
Okay.
Into the record. Any other nominations for vice chair at this point? Okay, and those nominations will also stay open until the beginning of our next meeting. So if you have another nomination, you can also send that to Pam Grove. Fred did have his hand up. Fred, did you want to add something?
Just to apologize for my lateness, my friends on the right, or on the left, I should say, no pun intended, beat me to it, and they ought to give me an opportunity to beat them the next time.
Fair enough. Okay. With that, then we'll go on to our next meeting. To actually vote on the chair and the vice chair for this committee for the next year. But again, nominations are officially open until the beginning of the next meeting in July. So I think at this point, I think Ashley's probably found a little traffic coming down here, and so if we could maybe go to the Pam's report, which we've all said we wanted to hear earlier in the meeting anyways. So by happenstance, we'll go straight to item 7, the staff liaison report. Pam?
Wow. Well, I might actually get to go through the whole report then. We'll see how much time I have. I'll have to thank Ashley later for that.
Yeah.
You may have noticed, I'll start from the back first, you may have noticed that the multi-axle vehicle tolls are due to go up July 1st. So if you know any truck drivers or recreational vehicle drivers, you might want to remind them of that. And also I pointed out the new South San Francisco Ferry service that has begun. And also a video that we did and showed in our public workshops, if you were at those in January, has won a California Public Information Officers Award. So we were very pleased to hear that, especially since yours truly was the narrator.
Yay!
The smart parking workshop information that Egon had asked for earlier this year is in your packet. And I know that Tina Neuhausel is not here today. She's taking advantage of that. So hopefully some of the others of you are also going to take advantage of those opportunities. And also, by way of letting you know about meetings we are having a series of Plan Bay Area Environmental Impact Review meetings, and that's in your staff report, but you may have also gotten this report, this postcard that was mailed out. I put some over there on the desk for you in case you want to pick some up and take hand some out to acquaintances that you know that might be interested in going to these meetings on the environmental impact review. And then last month, Carlos had asked for a high school internship update, so you'll find that as an attachment to the staff liaison report. It's a little more detailed than I think Carlos was asking for, but we wanted to give some of you some background that might not have known too much about the program. The big thing of note is the fact that last time we had, we think, around 250 applicants, and you'll notice that this time there were a total of 817 applicants. So the program is catching on, and people are learning about it and coming to the transportation table, which is exactly what the Minority Citizens Advisory Committee wanted when they created the program. So we're very excited about that. And to Carlos's question, the closing celebration for that program, which is often very inspiring, is going to be held on Thursday, August 2nd. Starting at 9 a.m. here in the Metro Center, and you will all be invited, and let me know if you would like to attend. And with that, I am done.
Yes, Richard.
Just to mention that Marshall and I attended the Smart Parking Workshop here yesterday, and they televised it. It's supposed to be on the web.
Oh, good.
So if you want to see it. Oh. I'm not guaranteeing it, but I was told by the people televising it they're going to put it on the website.
Egon?
Pam, just a quick question about the EIR meetings. Do you know any more about what the format is, what the audience is going to be asked to work on, how it might vary from the prior Plan Bay Area public workshops?
I think I will refer that question to Ashley since she's here to give us a presentation on the EIR, and she will hopefully be able to give us a little bit more information about those meetings as well.
Carlos?
Pam, thank you for the update on the internship program. And I don't know if this would be the time just to ask a question on the memo that was attached there. I'm really excited about the fact that it's catching on and that we're seeing almost like a doubling of applicants. But I was curious, and I maybe didn't understand this from the memo, but there was a timeline that was written out there about, I guess, December of 2011. There were 57 requests for internships, but it looks like from the table only 38. Can you explain why there seems to be a decrease in the number of actual opportunities?
It's actually not an increase from last year's program. Typically, MTC funds in between 30 and 40 interns every year, and that's based on budget limitations. We also give the requesters, so of those 57 requests from agencies, we give them an opportunity to fund an intern themselves. And as you'll see from the memo, quite a few agencies this time have taken us up on that offer. So we've actually expanded. I think we only had 35 interns last summer, so we expanded to 38. But we usually only fund right in that range of 30 to 40 just because of budget.
Randy?
Because it's budget time for a lot of our communities, if I were to ballpark what an internship would cost a city next year, what would I tell them?
I don't have the answer to that question, but I will ask it of staff that's running the program.
Because that would be great, because it's easier for me to go in with some actual data than...
Okay.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any other questions on that? Okay. Dolores, do you have a question? Your light's still on. No. Okay, perfect.
Sorry.
That's okay. So with that, why don't we step back now to item number 6, the Plan Bay Area EIR, Scope and Alternatives. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ashley Nguyen with MTC's Planning Section, and I'm here to walk you through some alternative concepts that we are putting forth through the scoping process, and then it'll eventually make its way into the EIR with some revisions and modifications. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of see where we are at with the environmental process. And I'll answer Aegon's question as we go through the presentation and certainly after. So just to give you a a sense of the overall framework for the plan. As you know, the three E's of sustainability, environment, equity, and economy really have served as guideposts for all the land use strategies and transportation policies and investments that we are making in this plan. And so for each of those three E's, staff is preparing a more technical report to demonstrate the impacts of the plan on that E. So for the first E, which is environment, we are preparing what's called an environmental impact report in accordance with state environmental law. The purpose of this environmental impact report is really to identify the significant impacts of the plan on the environment. As part of this environmental document, we have to evaluate a range of reasonable alternatives to the plan and determine whether or not the plan can avoid or mitigate significant impacts. The key benefit of this EIR has always been the CEQA streamlining opportunities. Lead agencies such as Caltrans, the congestion management agencies, and all the other transportation partners can use this document to really tier off of, meaning that they would have a more simplified environmental review when they move forward with more project-level environmental assessments for transportation projects that are indeed included in our financial constraint plan. However, what's new here is that because of SB 375 and the inclusion of a land use element in this plan, local jurisdictions may now also take advantage of the CEQA streamlining benefits, particularly those that are spelled out in SB 375 for certain development projects. For the second E, equity, staff is preparing an equity analysis. You've seen a lot of our equity assessment thus far for all the scenarios that have been evaluated to date. The purpose of the equity analysis is to really identify the benefits and burdens of the plan on different socioeconomic groups. There were a couple of metrics that were included in that equity analysis. The housing and transportation costs is certainly one of them. Displacement is another. And so the plan here is that we will do an equity analysis on the proposed plan, which is the jobs housing connection scenario that you saw a month or so ago. And we will also do the same level of assessment, an equity assessment, for the alternatives that will be evaluated in the EIR. We expect this equity assessment to be done in parallel with the EIR, and it's probably going to be released in about the same time, whether it's late December or early January 2013. And then lastly, for the third E, economy, we are for the first time producing what's known as an economic impact analysis. We've never done one before with our long-range plan, so this is, again, a first time for us. And very similar to the other two technical documents, the purpose of the economic impact analysis is to assess the economic impacts of the plan on a number of key regional economic areas. Key interest areas include state of good repair, the housing policy, the PDA land use and development strategies, and goods movement. This work is underway, and we're hoping that it will be completed in the November's December timeframe. Because it's really the first analysis for us, we really hope that the results of this economic analysis will inform future economic analysis that we do as part of our long-range plan. During last month's discussion of the preferred transportation land use strategy, the jobs housing connection scenario, and the complementary investment strategy, we did get some early input on the alternatives to be evaluated in the EIR. What we heard from the business community was the need to really start looking at assessing the market feasibility of priority development areas, particularly since these areas are taking on about 80% of the future growth in our region. We also heard that the plan ought to really refine some of the public policies to really shape market and consumer demands, as well as to identify policies that will really support local jurisdictions as they plan for and implement future development projects. We also heard from a number of equity stakeholders about putting a request on the table for us to study an environment, equity, and jobs scenario. The key elements of this scenario would be that we would restore transit service and we would allocate affordable housing in areas that are job rich. And so those were some of the early input that we received, and it's reflected in some of the concepts that we'll be sharing with you today. I wanted to point out that Senate Bill 375 allows for CEQA streamlining opportunities. And again, as I mentioned on the outset, This is something that local jurisdictions have really looked towards us to do as part of this sustainable community strategy process, because they really want to make sure that whatever they propose at their local level can really take advantage of some of the work that we do at the regional level. SB 375 allows for certain residential and mixed-use projects of certain densities and intensities to take advantage of the CEQA streamlining. They also call out this whole class, a new class of projects. They labeled it as transit priority projects. And transit priority projects, again, have to meet that certain residential and density-intensity threshold in order to qualify for CEQA streamlining. So as we were moving forward with the definitions of alternatives, this is certainly something we kept in mind to see if we can make this the alternatives analysis more meaningful, and then also to make this overall environmental more meaningful, particularly for those that can really use the environmental document again in their subsequent environmental review. Just to drill down a little bit more on the details, so the state laws allows for residential or mixed-use projects that are found to be consistent with the land use designation, the density intensities that are identified in the plan to take advantage of CEQA streamlining if that project is located in what is known as transit priority eligible areas. These are areas that are well served by transit, in particular 15-minute frequent transit service, and they meet all the densities and intensities threshold, it is possible for that project to be completely exempt from CEQA. So this is a really big benefit. They basically do not have to produce an environmental document. Another case is that if the project is located in a transit priority eligible area but doesn't meet all the CEQA exemption codes, they can still qualify for streamlined environmental review. They can produce a much more streamlined environmental document, which is new. It's called a Sustainable Communities Environmental Assessment. So there's a lot of benefit here in terms of allowing the local jurisdiction or the project sponsor really save some time and money in preparing a much thinner or skinnier document than you would normally see as part of the CEQA process. And then lastly, there is a class of mixed-use and residential projects that just meet the very minimal threshold under the state law, and those projects may also take advantage of CEQA streamlining, but it's in a very limited capacity. Just to give you a sense of where these transit priority eligible areas are, what we did is we mapped out the transit network and the frequencies and compared it to within a half-mile buffer. We basically overlaid it to those areas to kind of see where these transit priority eligible areas are. And then what we did on top of that was we overlaid it with the priority development areas. And so what you see on this slide is that the areas that are dark green, and just to give you a quick orientation, the two areas that we're showing you here for illustrative purposes is the San Francisco East Bay on my left, and then on the right is the Santa Clara area, San Jose downtown area. So what you see here, again, in the dark green are areas where there is really nice overlap between a priority development area and a transit priority eligible area. Again, this means that these areas are well served by high-quality transit. And what you see in the light green are other areas that, are transit priority eligible areas, but there are no PDAs identified within those areas. And the areas in red are those areas that are PDAs only, but really don't qualify under the state law definition of a high-quality transit area. And so to the extent that we can, in looking at this map and in thinking about the land use strategy for this plan, it'd be nice to see if we can get some more development occurring in certainly the dark green areas, but there's certainly other opportunities in the light green area that we might wish to explore as well. What I want to walk you through right now is the analytic tools that we will be using as part of this EIR, and they're relatively new. The Urban Sim is a new land use economic development model that was created by Paul Waddell of UC Berkeley. You might have been familiar with the Urban Vision tool that he created for us for use in engagement and outreach activities. So this is the same person, and it's the same level of thinking in terms of the analytics and the nuts and bolts of land use and economics. So the urban SIM model is very similar to the travel model that MTC has been using, which is really about taking explicit land use policies and really analyzing some of the more relevant behaviors and then coming out with some very detailed outcomes. Very much in the same way that our travel model works. And just to explain this a little bit more, because I know it's not that accessible, if you really look at the general plan for San Jose as an example, the San Jose general plan has pretty explicit general plan policies, and it informs the zoning ordinance for the city of San Jose. So Urban SIM takes those zoning information as a constraint. It has all the information within the model. And what it does is it goes through a market analysis based on how you and I would act in terms of our decisions as to where to locate in terms of buying or renting a house. It looks at where businesses would want to locate in terms of where they see a need to open a business. And it looks at developers' actions as well in terms of seeing which areas developers might want to develop or redevelop. So it really takes into account all those interactions in the marketplace to determine where development would occur. And then it would come out with some outcome. And in this case, based on the general plan policies for San Jose and our analysis of the market for areas near the new BART to San Jose extension, we might see two new five-story condo buildings built near those BART stations. And what we do with this information is we actually then feed it into the travel model. And the travel model then looks at the BART to San Jose extension. It goes through the analytics of looking at travel behavior. And what we see there is we see improved access to San Jose because now you have a new BART station. So now we have access improvements in San Jose. We have the general plan in San Jose. And then we feed that back into Urban SIM. Oops, I'm sorry. I took the arrow in the wrong direction. We take the accessibility information back into Urban SIM. And Urban SIM now tells us that instead of originally, without really understanding the BART to San Jose service, you only got 2 5-story condo buildings, but now with this improved access, you now get 2 new 7-story condo buildings. So there's a more of a market for higher intensity development. And so these are the 2 analytic tools that we'll be using as we go through the alternatives analysis and we're presenting those results in the EIR and as well as the other more technical reports that I mentioned early on. Urban SIM allows us, as I mentioned, to really test explicit land use policies. And what this slide shows you is the full range of policies that we could test within the model currently. Zoning, incentives such as the One Bay Area grants, as well as the CEQA streamlining benefits. We can look at fees and subsidies, developer fees, impact fees, other types of similar fees. We can also look at pricing, both on the road pricing side, as well as parking pricing and other parking policies. And we can also look at growth boundaries and natural areas, potentially more as constraints to development. So we have the full spectrum of land use policies that we can test using this model. And it's a matter of looking at all these different policies in combination to really see where we can best direct development to make sure we have a more sustainable development pattern, and also to maybe direct to constrain development in other areas that where we might not want to see growth. So in defining the EIR alternatives, our key objective on the land use side was really to look at ways we can really identify an efficient land use pattern, really to try to maximize the transportation investments that we're trying to make in this plan, particularly the hefty transit investments. As you know, we put quite a bit of the revenues in this plan towards maintaining our transit services and capital, as well as putting forth some really major transit capital expansions like BART to San Jose and others. And so we want to make sure that the land uses around those important transportation investments really are built up so we can really use those investments wisely. We're also looking to support housing choice and diversity. We're looking to also improve jobs housing fit to make sure there is that kind of fit and balance around the region. And we certainly want to continue to preserve our agricultural lands and open space. So that's the kind of objective and thinking that we went through in thinking about the land use. In terms of where we start and our overall approach, we really start with locally adopted general plans and zoning policies. This is key to the urban SIM model that I talked about, but it really is key in terms of really reflecting the land use policies that our local jurisdictions have put into place. We want to start there first as the basis for our evaluation. And then we'll test a number of different alternatives. Certainly the jobs housing connection scenario, which you've seen over the past month, will go through this rigorous test. And we'll also look at applying other land use policies to see, again, where we can best direct and constrain development. On the transportation side, we are, as you know, under state and federal planning regulations required to adopt a financially constrained plan. So we want to make sure that at the end of the day, we still have a plan that meets the federal requirements. But the approach we took in developing the alternatives is really to think about what's our starting point. And our starting point is usually where we are today, which is the existing transportation network, which for us is the year 2010. And then what we'll do is we'll test the preferred transportation investment strategy and match it up to the different land use strategies, or we might take the opportunity to modify that transportation investment strategy to see what the outcomes would be if we were to shift our investment priorities. And this allows us to really understand travel demand and particularly the relationship between transportation and land use and its interactions.
Ashley, excuse me. Let me see if so far, before we even talk about the specific different EIR alternatives that we have, does anybody have any questions thus far of the background material? And I'm going to go right around the corner and let us take just a quick breath and ask these questions so that then we can specifically talk about the different alternatives. So I'm going to start with Kathleen, Sandy, Richard, and then Federico, and then I'll come around to this side. Thank you.
Thanks, Ashley. In terms of going back to slide 6, where you set out the criteria for the transit priority project, are all of the areas that you've mapped as being TPP currently zoned to the floor area ratio?
No. Some are and some are not. And so that's something that we will look at as we think through the alternatives, because, again, what we want to do is provide as much opportunities as possible to local jurisdictions to take advantage of the CEQA streamlining. So we may make some recommendations for areas along high-quality transit to upzone.
Thank you. Sandy?
I also want to go back to that same slide. So can you clarify again? So the first part, residential mixed-use project, that would be in any area? I'm not sure what's the difference between the top and the bottom.
Right. The first one, the residential mixed-use project, could be in any area within our region. It just have to meet that minimum 75% of the footage being residential use. But remember, in the following slide, those projects that aren't really in transit priority eligible areas, they don't get the same level of CEQA streamlining as those that are. They do get a little bit, but not a lot. So that's the distinction. You can, in the first class, if you're a residential mixed-use project that is 75% residential use, you can qualify for CEQA streamlining. However, if you're in the second class, the transit priority project area, you get a lot more because there's a lot more at stake here. There's more residential development, higher intensity in terms of non-residential development, and you're really near high-quality transit.
And is it only mixed-use projects? It's not all residential projects that would...
I think the state law really was trying to encourage residential mixed use with an emphasis on mixed use, but they certainly wanted some commercial retail development within that.
Okay, so buildings that were all residential wouldn't get an exemption?
No, you don't. You have to be residential or mixed use, yeah.
And then on slide 7, you talked about there being other exemption criteria. Can you go into a little bit about what the other exemption criteria might look like?
Where are you?
In the green, blue, and red boxes.
Sure.
So the green and blue boxes.
The key benefit in terms of CEQA streamlining is not to have to repeat analysis that has already been done before. And across the board, growth-inducing impacts would be evaluated in our Plan Bay Area EIR. So projects that are going through their own project-level environmental document would not have to repeat that analysis. So that's one key area. And the other key area are resource areas that are evaluated at a cumulative level. And those areas would be our transportation, air quality, and climate change areas. And so if we evaluated those areas well in our Plan Bay Area EIR, local jurisdictions doing the project level EIR, again, do not have to repeat that analysis. They can just refer to ours and tier off of our document. And they would only focus on the other areas that would be more germane to their project.
Okay, so they'd still have to undergo an EIR. It just wouldn't have to include all of the elements.
That's right. In the box in the blue, they don't do an EIR. They do a different environmental document altogether. They do what's called as SCEA, a Sustainable Community Environmental Assessment. So if you imagine an EIR being 2 inches thick, this one may be an inch thick, much more streamlined, a different document, which, again, really saves local jurisdictions a lot of time and money in preparing that environmental document.
But so according to the Green Box, a project can be fully exempt and not have to do any CEQA at all.
That's right. But the bar is pretty high.
Okay.
You first meet these two things that are on the slide, plus a number of other things that really demonstrate that your project is completely exempt from CEQA altogether. There may be a few instances where certain development projects will fit in the green, but my sense would be that more projects will fit in the blue and red.
Okay, the reason I'm asking is because I'm concerned about health impacts that could be not addressed in here at all. So, and that's why I want to know, what are the other exemption criteria? So, you know, if you look at the criteria that's in here, it's just a matter of density, proximity to transit, and how much of it is residential. What else? What other criteria are looked at for a project to be fully exempt from having to do any EIR at all?
It's pretty rigorous. I would have to refer to the state law to give you a sense, but. I mean, just on your point about your interest or your concern about health issues, I would assist health issues at a localized level would not be something that we would cover in our Plan Bay Area EIR. So a project, whether it meets these areas or not, will likely, in their own project-level EIR, assess the localized health impacts.
They would still have to do that?
Yeah, because it's not considered a cumulative impact at a regional level.
Okay.
Therefore, in the more specific document, they would still have to address it. So, to your concern, I think it would be addressed at that level.
Okay, thank you.
Clarify that I was here last year where you did the urban SIM demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
Is that currently available for all the local jurisdictions?
We haven't rolled it out for use in the jurisdictions. I think what we're trying to do now is to work on the urban SIM model. And what we're hoping to do is once we get outputs from the urban SIM model, we can feed it into the urban vision model and then really, again, demo that tool. And certainly our ultimate plan is to make it available for jurisdictions to use.
Will it be available for when the Plan Bay Area is approved in April of next year?
I certainly hope so. I mean, we've completed the urban vision tool. It's ready for use, but it's just waiting for outputs coming from the urban SIM model. So once those two converge, you'll see some visualization using that tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll probably demo it again come probably January, February of 2013 when we go out and do another round of outreach on the plan.
Mm-hmm. Ken, on the PDAs, I think I read somewhere that they're divided into two. There's like the economic PDA and then there's a rural PDA. I think I read that somewhere, although... In a document, one of the MTC documents, I was just wondering, how many of the cities are classified in the economic as opposed to rural, and is there a standard that the cities that are on the economic are going to have to meet, some kind of a baseline standard?
Yeah, I have to say I'm not familiar. In the details of that, but I know that's a proposal that ABAG is considering, and there's still a lot of discussion.
Yeah, I think that's where I might have read it from. But I caught that part where it said the PDAs were, according to that definition, their definition or whoever's definition was classified as economic, and then there's a rural.
Yeah, I think the discussion has been around more of a. Are there additional place types that would really benefit rural communities so that they, too, can be poor development areas? And I think that's an ongoing discussion that I don't think there's been decisions made yet, but I think it's something that's worth tracking.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
I think we had Federico next.
Thank you. First, let me apologize if the answer to my questions are buried within the materials provided. If so, I didn't come across it, but... In reviewing what was there, I had some questions regarding what is referred to as scoping meetings, which I believe are scheduled for next week, the 20th through the 28th, I believe, in four areas, San Rafael, San Francisco, San Jose, and Oakland. I'm presuming, and correct me, of course, that these scoping meetings are to solicit input from the citizenry from those areas. I am concerned, if that is the case, why certain areas, why limited to those areas. I'm particularly concerned, being out of Contra Costa County, why my county of 1 million people are not included. I'm concerned as to areas like Vallejo and Solano, which are not included. And generally, if you look towards the eastern part of Alameda County, the growth areas, Dublin, Pleasanton, Livermore, why those areas are not included when those, along with areas like Brentwood, Oakley, Antioch, are the principal growth areas in terms of housing, feeding into that transportation, those highways, clogging them all up. Yet there's nothing there that I see soliciting the input from all these millions now of residents. I see primarily a focus on the hard urban core, with the possible exception of San Rafael. That is disturbing to me. Along that same line, I fail to discern the specific effort to seek the input relative to the elderly and disabled. My county has the largest single concentration of elderly individuals, i.e. look at Rossmore. But I am also concerned as to how you are going about soliciting with any specificity those concerns from the disabled community, along with those concerns from traditional minority communities, if you will. If you could respond to that, I would appreciate it.
Sure. I mean, the purpose of the scoping meeting is to get input from resource agencies, local jurisdictions, our transportation partners, and certainly members of the public on specific elements to be evaluated in the EIR. We do have a 30-day process to allow for folks to either attend one of the scoping meetings if they're available. If not, they can also submit written comments to us, and we'll take all comments and review them to make sure that we address any environmental issue to the extent possible within the context of our environmental document. So I think if there are opportunities that, if there are scoping meetings that are not available in an area where you live, I think the best thing to do is either write a written comment or certainly call me, and I'll be happy to talk you through the issues. But we are pretty much trying to cover the region. It's a pretty big area. We do try to put the meetings in places that we think are centrally located so that folks can attend if they're available to do so. So we did pick the three major cities, San Jose, Oakland, and San Francisco. And we did talk to the North Bay, our partners in the North Bay, and they felt that San Rafael is probably a good midpoint. So that's the rationale and reasoning for those things. But again, because you don't attend a scoping meeting doesn't preempt you from providing us with comments. And if you wanted to submit an email or a letter or a postcard, we certainly would accept those comments. The comments are specific to environmental issues that we would need to address in the plan. If you're concerned about how we do air quality or transportation, or you're concerned about biological resources or growth that's occurring in your community, those are things that we can certainly receive comments on, and we can really review and react to as we think about how we prepare the EIR.
But I think, Ashley, more directly to Federico's point, is there a way to get a fifth meeting in the Solano County area, and particularly targeted maybe towards the disabled senior groups, recognizing that you have four, but I'm paraphrasing what I thought I heard, so I'm just going to ask you more concretely and directly.
I think if there was an interest in the Solano community to meet with MTC staff about environmental issues, I'd be happy to host and hold that meeting, but I think at this point to add a fourth or a fifth scoping meeting may not be something that we can do given both time and just resources. But if there's interest in doing so, you know, and there's a community that wants to meet with me to talk about it, I'd be happy to go out and talk to that community.
Okay, well, maybe that'll be part of our discussion for later. Coming around the table, I've got Randy and Aegon. Okay.
I'm going to start off, and I'm not going to try and yell at you about this, but the statement that the scoping meeting is is targeted towards the agencies and the jurisdictions and not the communities themselves is a gross misrepresentation of what CEQA is all about and what an EIR is all about. And I will tell you that the San Jose BART station scoping meeting just for that project turned out hundreds of people because we have a very well-trained community on EIRs. I can't speak to the other communities, but scoping meetings and the EIR process is CEQA's way, it's the way that the community participates. So kind of piggybacking off of all of these statements, I have grave concern about this process reflecting the community as opposed to reflecting the self-interest of a transit agency for instance. And they could be paralleled interests, but I think you're missing the point. And I don't know of any outreach that's been done to my community. So I'd like an explanation of how that is being done to the community itself, not to the agencies, not to the planning department, but to the actual people who have an interest in this. Because when I look at the intent of this, and I truly get it, I'm looking at a huge segment of San Jose that would be CEQA exempt, and CEQA is the community's way of controlling what goes on in their area, and of getting mitigations. So that's a big issue for me. And you made another statement in the slide on slide six says at least 75% of the building square footage. And I think when you said the statement when Sandy was talking about it before, you talked about the building being 75%. I think you meant the project, didn't you?
No, the building.
The building itself, because our mixed-use projects that come in generally have the mixed part, the non-residential part, can be a second building within the project. So you're talking about each project now has to provide, I mean, each building has to provide a 75-25 split when, in fact, you could get a 75-25 split with an office building and a condo sitting right next to it.
I don't disagree with that example. The language that you see is coming straight from state law.
Okay. That's kind of scary. So just going back to the San Jose BART station, that BART station, for instance, wouldn't qualify at all.
That's right. There's very specific language in SB 375 about what qualifies for CEQA streamlining and what doesn't. So there are a lot of details with regards to that specific project. I mean, what the state law tries to do is to provide that benefit, but it also sets a bar that they want certain development projects to take advantage of those benefits for the reason that you just mentioned, which it's not to preempt or sidestep CEQA altogether because environmental review is still important, but there are certain projects that they are looking for to support and provide a little bit of CEQA streamlining benefits to.
And I get that, but a 10-acre project that is a mixed-use project would require each building to have 25% commercial, and that's just not feasible at times because it doesn't take into account step downs towards lower level areas. So, and I get that that's not your problem. The other thing that I want to know on the analytical tools, are you now taking into account existing approved projects? And I'll go back to the Berryessa BART area. Because when you use that as an example, I know what the layout is there. And so what I don't want to see is anybody coming to my community with a great snazzy tool that doesn't reflect an existing project.
We have all the existing land uses in Urban Sim, and then we have all the general plan policies and zoning codes within Urban Sim. So if it's an existing project, it would be reflected in our land use database. If it's an approved project, meaning it just received approval, but it's maybe not into construction, we would not necessarily have that in our database.
Okay. Is there a way for you to target, because that's going to be a big problem for you in San Jose.
But if the project is already in within the general plan zoning codes, that project would be already reflected in our plan and in the model in that respect.
Okay.
We might not have this tower being built because it was just approved by the San Jose City Council 2 years ago. But if the zoning for that building is already hardwired into the San Jose zoning ordinance, that building, that place on that parcel would already be taken. It may not have that specific tower ABC on it.
Okay. But, okay, I'll talk to you offline about that then, because I don't think that's... I just don't want you coming in and meeting a community that's going to be really upset about seeing...
Yeah, just remember
that... Actually a degradation of the plan.
Just so. Remember again that we're talking about a regional assessment, regional alternatives. We won't be able to drill down to the community level the way you would as you go through a community planning process, because we're just giving you proxies of what future growth patterns might look like. We won't tell you that developer A is going to build a two-story building. That was just for illustrative purposes to kind of show you how the model works. But it's not that we're proposing a two-story building here or a five-story building there. And I think that's maybe where you're coming from in terms of really looking at the local context. We don't look at the local context at that level. We really do elevate it more to a regional context.
Okay, but then that's the problem when you take it to a local level, when you take it to a local meeting. Just so you know, that's the problem.
And that's the reason why I wanted to distinguish between what we do with this EIR, which is a very program-level EIR that looks at regional impacts, which would be considerably different than what a local jurisdiction would do when they work with a developer to develop an EIR for a project. They're going to be looking at the local impacts, and there's going to be a lot more specific buildings and parcels and zoning, much more specific than we could ever get at this regional level.
Okay, and can you go back to my first question, which I never gave you a chance to answer, which is how is the outreach being done to the general public for these meetings?
We do have, what I said was that the scoping meeting is to really get comments on the scope and content of the environmental document from resource agencies, local jurisdictions, certainly our partner agencies, and the community. So everyone that we have that's been involved in the general in the Plan Bay Area process have received notification that these scoping meetings are taking place. So we do try to get a full breadth of input from everyone who has an interest or a concern or an issue that they would like to evaluate in the EIR.
So you emailing me is in lieu of a public... So I would have to know... If I hadn't attended one Bay Area meeting and I wasn't on your email list, and it's... Say it's the person that lives next door to me that's never been to any of these meetings, how would they be notified in any way, shape, or form of these meetings is where I'm going. Because if somebody lives in the North Bay and wants to put input on this, somebody in Napa who doesn't have a meeting in their area, how do they?
I mean, I can tell you the means by which we're distributing notice that we are going through scoping. But I want to, again, distinguish between what you would receive as a resident for a local project coming into your area. That's a different standard of outreach altogether. What we're trying to do as part of this is it's regional in nature. It's a regional document, and we're holding regional scoping meetings, trying to touch our bases as much as we can. We certainly are using our contact database from all those folks, again, as I mentioned, that have been involved in the Plan Bay Area process to date. We certainly have a web presence in terms of having this information available online, and we do email blasts. I mean, I think we're trying to reach as much as we can, and we do the legal requirements in terms of filing the NOP as well. We're specifically, as you are familiar with CEQA, required to contact resource agencies. This would be fish and game, state conservation, the water departments, really have them comment, because they will more likely, they have resource areas that are under their purview that we need to be aware of when we do our analysis. So there's a reason why resource agencies are involved in environmental processes. But we try to do really the full gamut. If you're asking if I'm able to reach every single resident of the Bay Area and notify them scoping, clearly we're not able to do that. But I think to the extent that we're capturing those interested and have been really engaged in the process, we're doing really our best to make sure that they're aware of the process.
Agon, and then Rich Hedges.
So I think Randy raises an interesting point back to the SB 375 drafting, and maybe that's something we can talk about in the second part, or after the second half of Ashley's presentation, getting back to maybe suggestions for MTC's legislative agenda. My personal view is that's a drafting flaw in SB 375 based on an over-assumption about housing being the priority around transit. Quick question, though, for Ashley, for you about the slide number 9, power of analytic tools. Could you say a little bit more about the the types of assumptions for consumer preference that are within the current model, the particular coefficients that are there. And I know it's a complicated set of things, but what I'm interested in understanding is what are those, because those are driving a lot of the decisions about where things go, and if those are going to be public somewhere.
Maybe it's not best for me to answer that question, one, because I don't know the dirty details of everything that goes into the model in terms of the trends and assumptions, but certainly we can talk to you in greater detail on one-on-one if you would like to get more under the hood about the model. But we do have, we have been developing this model over the past year with Paul Waddell of UC Berkeley. We do intend to have full technical documentation as to what this model is, what's included, our assumptions, and so we'll have the breadth of that technical information. But if you wanted to have more of a conversation with us to understand some of the mechanics of the model, we'd be happy to do so.
Okay, yeah, and I can follow up with you and Mike and others. And it's just because it's important, because it drives a lot of the initial decisions about where development goes. And then to the extent that the market isn't supporting development in one place or another, then the additional barrier to achieve a concentrated pattern falls on the policy side. Mm-hmm. And I know that's more the focus of this group. So I think it's of interest to us the extent to which changes in market preference from a generational standpoint are really being incorporated into that. But I'll follow up. Thanks, Ashley.
Will you, thank you.
Oh, I'm so ashamed I keep forgetting that. Randy actually brought up a good point, actually a question in my mind. It's just a question, no comment. If you have any crystal ball into what the legislature was thinking, it seems to me, based on your comment, that 75% of it had to be in the same structure, residential, commercial mix, it sounds like they were driving at something Long Beach did in her downtown, with all the retail on the ground floor for blocks and blocks, with each building being about a block, and with three, four, five stories of residential above. Is that what they were driving at with 75% within the same building?
No, I'm unable to get into the heads of the authors of the Senate bill. But
that would have been cool if they'd been driving at that.
I think the upshot is that really what they wanted to do is to encourage certain types of developments around high-quality transit, because they really wanted to think about, if you're going to put a transit service out there and it's operating at pretty darn good levels, 15-minute headways, or you're making a major BART extensions or a light rail extension or putting in new bus rapid transit, you certainly want the lane uses around there to support it, because you want to be able to generate that ridership to really support that investment. And I think the details may have been lost because that's how, you know, isn't there a cartoon about how a bill is created? But there's certain things that are lost as you go through the bill structure, and the details may have been moved around quite a bit. But I think the upshot, again, is can we get higher intensity development around our transit?
Yeah, and that's exactly what Long Beach did, because the blue line wiggles its way all through that development. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you for answering those clarifying questions for us. And Ashley, why don't we go ahead then and go on with the discussion about the specific EIR alternatives? Thank you.
So I think I stopped about here. This gives you an array of about five alternatives that we have put on the table for discussion, and will undergo the scoping process. And these different alternatives, one or two might be carried forth, others might be changed dramatically, some will drop out altogether, and we may have new options for consideration. And that, again, is all subject to the comments and feedback that we receive through the scoping process. The first one is the NOPE project, and this is certainly something that is required under CEQA to evaluate. And the purpose of the NOPE project is to really understand the impacts of the plan or project that you're proposing in comparison to some sort of NOPE project, some sort of baseline. So you really can see the delta between what your project did in terms of potential significant impacts. And so this is something that will definitely be part of the set of alternatives to be evaluated in this EIR. Alternative number two and three have a focused growth theme. And you're very familiar with number two, which is the Jobs Housing Connection strategy, which was approved for further evaluation by both the Commission and the ABAG Board back in May. And so we'll carry this this alternative forward through full assessment in the EIR. And it's what we call the CEQA project, which means it's the proposed project that will be evaluated in full in our environmental assessment. The third one is right now labeled Network of Transit Neighborhoods. Again, the name and content of any one alternative, 3, 4, and 5, is subject to change as we move forward. But we are looking at ways under this alternative to encourage more development in those transit priority eligible areas. Hence, continue to focus growth and basically direct more higher intensity development to support our transit investments. Number four, right now, is labeled the workforce housing opportunities. And this one is a little bit different from the others in terms of it really tries to basically create jobs for all those that for residents who typically would hold a job in the Bay Area but maybe live elsewhere in the surrounding region, those living in Stockton and traveling to the Bay Area for jobs. And so what we want to do as part of this alternative is really try to eliminate that in commute so that folks that work in the Bay Area actually live in the Bay Area. And the last one is themed equity, and this again was the alternative that was requested by a number of equity stakeholders for us to evaluate. And it had those two components, restore transit service and putting more affordable housing in job-rich communities. And I'll walk you through each of these in a second. So again, the NO project is required under CEQA for evaluation. There's two components for any one alternative that I'll walk you through today. On the land use side, for the NO project alternative, we start with the 2010 existing land use conditions. So whatever we see today that's on the ground will be the basis for which we will define the NO project. On top of that, we will look at all the general plans and the local zoning and assume that those local policies that have been adopted by cities and counties will continue to exist into the future, into 2040. One key thing that we wanted to highlight is that a number of jurisdictions in our region have adopted urban growth boundaries or have something very similar, like urban service boundaries, where they have said in their own general plans that they would discourage development encroaching along those boundaries or certainly outside of those boundaries. So we do assume that those adopted policies are in place, but we know from practice that in some instances, there are sometimes opportunities for development outside of those urban limit lines or urban growth boundaries, and those developments certainly have occurred. So we wanted to make sure that this NO project alternative really reflects not only what's adopted policies, but actually what's maybe happening in practice. On the transportation side, we again will be using the 2010 existing transportation network. It's a network system that you see in place today. And what we did here is we assume that there are certain projects that would continue in the future. And those projects are those that have full funding and would be implemented with or without any action that the Commission and ABAG make on this plan. They will continue to move forward. Therefore, they will likely occur in the future. And there's also a set of projects that have received full funding and have gone through the environmental process. And we deem them as committed projects as part of this plan. So those projects would occur with or without any action on the part of the MTC and ABAG. So the two combined make up the NO project alternative. The Jobs Housing Connection scenario, just as a quick refresher, on the land use side, the general strategy here was about directing growth into priority development areas. These are areas that local jurisdictions said they wanted to grow. And ABAG really respected that by placing 80% of the future growth in those areas. Certainly, there's been a lot of questions about whether or not 80% is the, maybe the upper range, and if there may be, in some instances, interest in something a little bit lower on a PDA by PDA basis. But that's something that certainly has been subject to discussion and debate over the past several months. The policy measures to implement this plan and what it would take to facilitate that future growth pattern is still something that we're exploring as part of this analysis. And on the transportation side, you received presentations in the past about the preferred transportation investment strategy. This is the $277 billion and how we focused most of our discretionary action about something to the tune of 88% on maintaining and operating the existing road and transit system. And then we you know, with the discretionary monies, we focused on a number of different investment strategies. And so the two combined make up the jobs housing connection alternative. This third alternative, what we did here was, again, our thinking here was that is there an opportunity for us to not only direct growth into priority development areas, but also these other opportunity areas that are eligible under the state law for CEQA streamlining, these transit priority eligible areas. And so the intent of this alternative is to really see if we can direct growth in those areas and constrain growth in other areas that we may not wish to see development. And so we'll be using a number of different land use policies to direct that growth into priority development areas as well as transit priority eligible areas. We'll do that through upzoning to make sure that, again, there's a higher intensity of development near our transit network. We'll apply incentives such as OBAG and the CEQA streamlining to, again, attract developers to develop or redevelop in those areas. And then on the flip side, we will be looking at maybe some sort of fee structure to really discourage development. And we will be looking at holding the line in terms of the adopted urban growth boundaries so that we make sure that there isn't development beyond those urban limit lines or service areas. And then we'll be testing the preferred transportation investment strategy alongside this land use strategy as part of this alternative. For this fourth alternative, we have the an opportunity here to test an alternative that allows all the Bay Area jobs to be filled by Bay Area workers. Therefore, no one has to continue to buy a home outside our region and then commute in for jobs within our region. And what we would like to do is start with alternative three, the network of transit neighborhood alternative land use strategy, because that's the kind of places where we want to grow. And so if there was opportunities to accommodate more jobs and more housing in our region, we would look to start there first, and then we would fill in terms of the remaining parts of the region. We would still try to, at least in concept right now, really start thinking about not encouraging more greenfield development. So we would like to place two policy levers of both fees and the growth boundaries to maybe constrain that development. And that's kind of the concept behind the land use. And then for the transportation, what we're putting on the table for discussion is to modify the preferred transportation investment strategy in two ways. First is to look at the existing transit network and seeing if we can make that network more efficient and more sustainable based on some of the work that's coming out of the Transit Sustainability Project. As you may know, San Francisco MTA as well as VTA have prepared transit efficiency plans, which are what's called Comprehensive Operations Analysis, COAs. And VTA has already made good on that transit effectiveness plan, and MTA is in the progress of doing so. So we want to represent those transit efficiency plans within this transit network. And then there's some work that's being done for AC Transit and BART as well, and so we want to be able to capture some of the efficiency improvements that they're making on those systems as part of the revision to the transit network under this strategy. And we're also looking at our express lane, the regional express lane network, and potentially just testing only the HOV lane conversions, because there's been quite a bit of interest in looking at our express lane network and seeing if there's options there. And so the two combined make up the transit network. But on top of that, what we want to do is to see if we can test some pricing policies to see if there's any influence on travel demand. And so we'll be looking at potentially a VMT, maybe a little bit some parking pricing to see if we can really influence that travel demand so that we really don't see high VMT in our region, and that we can really start looking at ways to improve parking and better managing parking at the local level. And the fifth one is the environment, equity, and jobs alternative. And here, for the land use, we're going to start with a no-project land use. And the intent is, again, to provide more affordable housing in areas that have really high job accessibility, those areas most likely having a lot more job creation. So we want to make sure we have a jobs housing fit or balance in those areas. And we'll do that through three different land use mechanisms. One is upzoning. We may need to upzone certain areas that are likely high job creators to make sure that they do have the zoning in place to support higher intensity affordable housing developments. And we'll also look at incentives and fees to really try to encourage that kind of development and, again, discourage other kinds of development that we may not be so interested in. And on the transportation side, here again, we will propose a modification to the preferred transportation investment strategy. The request on the table was to restore transit service levels. So we are looking at restoring transit service levels back to 2005, which is a pretty good year for transit service in comparison to maybe some of the things that have occurred between now and then. So we want to test that service level in this strategy. And again, we'll repeat the work that we're doing on the express lane and really just test the HOV lane conversions. This slide shows you the potential revenues that we could redirect from the preferred investment strategy to pay for the two modification on the transportation side, really in support of increasing transit services. So we, for illustrative purposes, say that there's a potential to redirect about $6 billion, and maybe that $6 billion will help pay for some of the transit improvements that are contemplated in the latter two alternatives. As we move forward into the scoping process, the key scoping questions for the alternatives are shown on this slide. We're basically looking for input on, in thinking about the definition of alternatives and thinking about the policies that would need to be in place to, again, direct or discourage development, what are the appropriate policy levers that we need to think about, both on the land use and transportation side. And if there's some strategies that are missing in the alternatives that folks would wish for us to explore, we certainly would like to hear comments on that. And then if there's alternative ideas that we didn't think of in these five that are really something that that folks think are a good idea, we certainly would like to hear from them. And then in thinking about what that new idea would be in terms of an alternative, we also want some specific information about the land use and transportation strategies that ought to be tested as part of that alternative idea. This slide shows you the EIR schedule. As some of you may know, last week we presented the same presentation to the Joint MTC Planning and ABAG Committee. We issued our notice of preparation for the EIR and notices of the scoping meetings that will take place over the next week or so, or next 2 weeks, actually. Our intent is to get all the feedback that we get during the scoping process over the next month and think about them in terms of redefining and reshaping the alternatives that we've presented here, and then present the final alternatives for review by the Joint MTC ABAG committees on July 13th for their review and comment. And this will allow us, following a board action by both the Commission and ABAG board on July 19th, to move forward with those alternatives for evaluation in the EIR. Our plan is to prepare the draft EIR between the months of July and December, and we hope to have a draft EIR that we could release for a 45-day public review in December, mid-December. We will be going through the formal public hearing process on both the draft plan and the EIR in January, and this will give us some time to get the feedback on the draft plan as well as the EIR, and for on the EIR side, be able to respond to comments received during the months of February and March. And our plan is still to move forward with presentation of a draft plan and a final EIR for approval by the MTC Commission and the ABAG Executive Board in April of 2013. So with that, I'll close and be happy to take additional questions.
Great. Thank you, Ashley. Lori, we'll have you kick it off.
If we can go back to slide, I believe that's slide 17. Good question on that one. So, I guess my question would pretty much cover all of these slides. So this EIR scenario or whatever, and the scoping meeting for the EIR, would this require, in order to implement this plan, would it require that most cities and counties update their zoning ordinance and their general plan so that it can meet all of these preferred options?
No. Senate Bill 375 is very clear on this issue. In developing a sustainable community strategy, there's nothing in the law that requires local jurisdictions to update their general plans and zoning ordinances to reflect what's adopted in the sustainable community strategy. What they do have to do is they have to update their housing element in response to both the regional housing needs allocation, which would be consistent with a sustainable community strategy. But it's their option to look at their general plan policies and make changes, but that's not something that is required in state law.
So if they just updated their housing elements and doesn't reflect this, that means they're going to go back. They're going to have to go back and make an amendment before the next update in order to be able to receive certain funds or meet certain guidelines under this policy.
No, I think there's on the housing element side, housing elements now have an 8-year update, and ABAG has just gone through the regional housing needs allocation process to define the methodology for how each jurisdiction will take its share of the region's housing need. Jurisdictions will have to update their housing element to meet this new 8-year cycle. But they would do that independent of the work that we're doing on the EIR.
Oh yeah, I'm familiar with that. So the bottom line is that they're going to have to update their housing elements. If they in fact have just done that, they're going to have to update that to reflect.
That's right, because all the housing elements expire, I believe, October of 2014 or something like
they're
that.
They're not going to all expire at the same time.
They're not all at the same time, but right. That's the kind of the cutoff in terms of the new 8-year cycle.
Okay, all right, and. So then I have another question regarding, do you anticipate a certain number of attendees for all the various locations where you're going to have the scoping meeting? And if you don't get a large group of individuals attending at these various locations, do you plan to have a second scoping meeting?
No. Actually, the scoping meetings that we've done in the past has been quite lonely ones. We do not have crowds and crowds of folks coming into our meetings. We do get lots of correspondence because you can submit written comments either at the scoping meeting or post-scoping meeting. So long as we get comments, we will respond to them. The opportunity for the scoping meeting is to really provide an opportunity for us to go through and explain the EIR other than the more formal writings of what's in the EIR and to really allow us to answer questions and clarify issues in the EIR. We will be taking oral comments and we'll record them, but we'll also encourage written comments. So it's a combination of both what's spoken at the meetings as well as the written comments that we will respond to.
No, I get what a scoping meeting is. I understand that, but I was asking that in case you don't get. I'm just concerned about some of the other questions that were raised earlier.
Yeah.
That maybe there's not enough because I, you know, living in Vallejo, I'm not even sure if we get a large number or a group of people from Contra Costa. I mean, from Solano County or from Vallejo, that will come to the scoping meeting in Marin, if you have one there, or in Oakland. I mean, you have to cross the bridge and get there, especially for the seniors and older ones who may want to, or even younger ones who may want to attend. So, and then in terms of actually putting out notice about this, I was just thinking that if it's not too late. Perhaps you could get with the cities in each of these jurisdictions, these counties, and the cities and the counties, and then just have them posted on their website that there's going to be a scoping meeting that's going to take place in these locations.
We can certainly pursue that idea, but just back on the meeting attendance, I don't have a prediction of how many people will come. I certainly hope to get a very good audience so that we can be able to go through and explain this to a lot of stakeholders. So there is no quota about how many people come in to qualify as a meeting. But we certainly, again, if there's other engagement opportunities that you wish for us to explore, we'd be happy to go out and speak to those organizations. I'm meeting with local jurisdictions over the next 2 weeks to kind of get the word out on the EIR process and really get them involved as well. So I could certainly ask them to potentially post a notice of this on their respective websites. So that's a good idea.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all.
Randy, and then Aegon, Kathleen, and then Linda.
I just want to note this is a really aggressive EIR schedule. I've seen projects take 3 times as long, much less a regional one. So congratulations to having the staff to be able to do such an aggressive timeline. But my concern is the 45-day period that hits in December, because most municipalities have furlough weeks. And so you're releasing it about a week before everybody goes on furlough for 2 weeks in my community. So the staff that would actually be reviewing the EIR and responding during that 45-day period, you've just taken 15 days of that 45 days out of the picture. I don't know how the other jurisdictions are, but my planning department consists of nothing but empty cubicles right now. So and a bunch of hard drives from the people that used to work there. So I'm just concerned about that, and I would ask what I ask anybody who presents an EIR or releases one in December, and that's to extend it for at least 2 weeks, that open time, to allow people who are on furlough or vacation or who are doing holiday stuff to actually have the time, an actual full 45 days.
Well, I certainly, in counting the 45 days, certainly did not account for furloughs. So this is certainly a new factor. But it did exclude all the holidays, but certainly not holiday time.
We furloughed, so.
Yeah. I mean, we are required under CEQA to have the 45-day review, the 30-day, 45-day review period. So we try to stick with what's required of the law. But, you know, if the comments came in a day or two after the 45-day public comment period, we often continue to consider those comments as well.
Those days are your floors. They're not your ceilings. So
no, I get that.
So that's where my concern is.
Aegon, and then Linda, and then Kathleen.
Great. This is really clear, Ashley. Thank you for presenting it. I'm just starting on the high level of kind of looking at the five scenarios. I guess I have a funny feeling of deja vu back to when we had five alternatives back last year. And my only question on this, and I actually see it's really clear. I want to spend a little time just kind of talking through this. It's very clear the distinctions between these. I hope there's significant distinctions in the output that comes out of them, but I still feel like there's a way that you could do this that would force differences that are greater among what you've presented. So, for example, clearly there's the no project, clearly there's the preferred scenario you've got to do. The network of transit neighborhoods is sort of another way of saying a more concentrated pattern, but you're clearly not using the words urban core and edge, which had a lot of political pushback. But I feel like maybe there's the need to say that or be more explicit about what you mean there. And on the land use side, should there be two different kind of land use visions, one that is truly even more concentrated and dense than the preferred scenario, and one that is more decentralized and kind of pattern? And I know we sort of had those words in the last time, and I don't want to get too much in the details, but I feel like there's an iteration on your way of explaining these that it gets a little bit more into something that we can see the differences between them. Particularly on a specific level, on the network of transit neighborhoods, your transportation scenario isn't that different, or you're just sort of taking the preferred one. It seems to me like that would be the one where you ought to put some of your real different, your tweaks to the transportation strategy, like your, whether it's your VMT fee, parking pricing, the TEP stuff from San Francisco VTA work, and getting rid of the expansion lanes. It seems like that would fit into there. So that's sort of one comment on the transportation side, but as well as thinking through a little bit on the land use distinctions within them. The workforce housing opportunities one, that is very clear. And just to make, if you could be explicit about what you mean, does that eliminate the current in commuting or simply not increase the total number above the current level of in commuting? And I think you understand what I mean by the distinction there.
It's an elimination of the 155,000 that's projected over the next 25 years.
So and so then what would be the, how do you know what the housing unit number for the region would be?
I do not. That's analysis that is underway. So we will have a different number of housing units and jobs tested as part of this alternative.
And so then we would then see the potential positive, potentially economic impact of that scenario relative to the others as part of your economic impact analysis.
That's correct.
Okay. I think that one is a really clear difference because of the whole policy debate around whether or not we deal with the in commuting. On the environment, equity, and jobs one, what you talk about sort of the restoration of the 2005 service level cuts, but could you say a little bit more about the demand that type of a scenario might create for new transit service in job-rich places that don't have transit now? It seems to me like to properly put transit in places that are job-rich, you might need to add service. And my personal view, there's some potential contradiction between that view as being positive towards equity because it might take dollars from transit service in the urban core and put it to places that have jobs but not transit today. So if you could say a little bit more about that and how that might be tested.
I certainly would agree with your comment there in terms of some of the effects that may not be so obvious in thinking about restoring transit services. But we certainly will test that, and we will produce those outcomes in terms of what it does to communities' concerns and what it does for other areas, and maybe the need for additional transit services in those areas now that you have both more housing and more jobs in those areas that may not necessarily be served by transit. So I think we'll call that out as we go through our analysis and explain the results. But I think I would certainly agree with the point that you just made.
Okay, and then finally, two other quick things. One is you mentioned road pricing in the very beginning, but then I didn't see it appear as one of the policy tools. Which of these scenarios would it be included in? And my suggestion is at the very minimum, it certainly should be a number 3 and presumably number 4. But if you could say, and maybe say a little bit more about what type of road pricing you're going to be testing in this.
For number 4, we use the VMT fee as the proxy for road pricing. And we haven't defined what that fee structure would look like and how and where it would be applied, but that's where we're putting it right now.
So my understanding of a VMT fee could potentially apply to new development, but it's more on the development side, not on the mobility side, whereas road pricing would put a specific price on travel behavior. So it seems to me, my personal suggestion, I don't know if others agree, is that the road pricing ought to be really exploring tolls on existing highways, something that really gets at the individual demand or decision about traveling in a particular place. So what you're saying is there's not currently a place for road pricing in this, although I thought that was going to be included in the EIR, and you'd noted that previously.
I think that's something that we can certainly explore, and if we were to receive comments on that respect, is something that we'll certainly consider.
Well, maybe I'll ask Ann or Steve, because I believe at 2 months ago we had discussed this and we were told that specifically would be tested in the EIR alternatives.
You know, now is probably as good a time as any. Ashley mentioned there are two alternatives here that we are required by law to include. The other three are completely up for grabs, and I cannot emphasize that enough. We have made no decisions about anything you're seeing on 3, 4, and 5, and you shouldn't assume we have. And until we go through the scoping and get a sense of what everybody has on their mind, I don't think it's appropriate for us to make any decisions or commitments, one way or the other. Personally, looking at these, the way they're lining up, you know, we have some fees on one scenario and some fees on another. I think that might confuse the hell out of everybody. It might make more sense, if you're going to do them, to do them on all of them and show what the difference is when you start layering them on, which is something this tool can do. So, you know, this is the risk we run in trying to put some options out for people to think about. They think, oh, we've already decided that's what we want to do, and we haven't, and we're not here to defend them to you. We're here just to try to provoke some discussion,
so then,
which we've apparently been successful at doing.
So then I guess the friendly request would certainly be to really explore that. But
tell us what you think. That's what we're here for.
I think a version of road pricing that specifically explores putting tolls on existing highways, existing unpriced lanes, not in the hot lane scenario, both for the potential revenue benefit as well as the potential impact on travel behavior. This the EIR scoping or the EIR process is exactly the time to study something like that. And whether that goes in all of them or one, I think there is a certain clarity in applying that for all and the distinctions between them being something like housing all the in-commute, because that's a very clear logic. Last point, just on the redirect funding piece, so just the question and then the comment. The question is, this is saying taking $6 billion and redirecting that to transit operating over the course of the entire plan, transit operating across some number of the 27 different operators. Okay, and then the comment on that is that it seems to me there's often debate happens here, and I know your executive director has a particular view, I believe, on the transit capital replacing, taking capital, putting to operating, but could you say a little bit more about which capital might be taken out of that $8.3 billion sort of the $2.6 billion in capital and what potential implications. It seems like to me that that might not be the best source of funding, nor the OBAG as ones to take from to put into transit operations.
Well, you do recall correctly, I think this is a lousy idea. But there are a group of folks who would like to restore transit service that has been reduced. And the requirement that we're under in doing these alternatives is they have to be feasible. Each of them has to be able to be accomplished. And the only way you can do that is to rob Peter to pay Paul. We don't have any spare transit operating money lying around. Now, the transit capital replacement is probably the most direct way to get it because it's specifically allowed under federal law to shift the money from one to the other. But it does have the effect of reducing the amount of money available for transit rehabilitation, for buying cars and buses and fixing rail track. And we have humongous shortfalls to do all that stuff. So there may be other places we can go, but the rest of these ideas, frankly, get even more complicated in terms of trying to move the money. It's almost like that old double play combination, you know, Tinkers to Evers to Chance. We got to keep moving the money from one place to another to try to get it to transit operations. The bottom line here for all of you to consider is it's a trade-off. If you want to run more buses, you got to take the money from somebody else, and it may be something else you want to do too. But the rule here is you can't print money. You got to live within the same budget.
So I think, I think maybe the last two, the Regional Express Lane Network and the FPI could be a source of this. But this is one where in the discussion of it, it might, to the extent that there's a dialogue and people are confused, one very clear idea that all of you have heard from the Transit Sustainability Project is certain kinds of transit capital investment will speed up transit service, which in effect is an increase in transit service. And so that I would want to make sure that if, as that discussion goes forward, people are reminded of that question because that's a way to do things. Lastly, a really quick question. Will all the alternatives attempt to meet the 15% per capita GHG reduction target, or will you just sort of,
Not necessarily. I think we'll let the chips fall where they may.
And make the decisions about sort of what goes into it and then see how that goes out.
Right.
At the end. Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have Linda and then Kathleen.
Well, Aegon covered quite a few of the things that I was going to say.
Excellent job.
The one thing, though, that I'd like to go back and clarify, and that's very short, is that the entries to our area, we have a lot of people coming into our area that for jobs and things like that. And we're talking about that all these new jobs are going to be filled by Bay Area residents, but that isn't necessarily true, especially like when you look at the PDA in Livermore and the commute over the Altamont, unless, of course, we do road pricing and charge people to come into Alameda County. I'm not suggesting that. But I really think that we need to look at that because probably the major problem of 580 is people coming in from outside the area.
The reason we want to test this idea of there's no in commute again, right? That in fact, don't we take Ashley all the people who are in commuting today and we stop it? They have to live here now. So we repatriate them, if you will, in the model. You got to suspend disbelief a little bit. This is sort of like going to a play. But there is, I think, a disagreement among reasonable attorneys that I've heard about what the law actually requires us to do. There's one view that says you have to not only stop in-commuting from growing in the future, but you have to also prevent all the people who are doing it today from doing it anymore. You know, you have to build that many houses. There's another view, which I'm more inclined to, because I think it frankly makes more sense, which is that you only have to stop the growth, right? That generally laws are prospective, they look forward, they usually don't apply retroactively and try to get you to do something different in the past. But the reason we're trying to study both is to cover our base on both. You know, we've talked a lot about CEQA today. One thing CEQA does do sometimes is produce litigation. And I think we need to be mindful that we live in a fairly litigious region. One of our counterparts, San Diego, has already been sued under CEQA for their sustainable community strategy. So I don't think it's out of the question that we will be too, and we want to make sure our defense is as strong as possible. So that's the reason it's there. I don't disagree with some of the unreality of the idea that somehow we're going to pry people out of their cars at the border and say, you have to go house hunting now in Dublin, you know?
Okay. Well, I have another question, too. I don't see in here anywhere where we've talked about the schools or those kinds of infrastructures that are needed for the expanded neighborhoods. Is that all part of it, or?
No, we don't address schools.
We're just going to let the school districts sweat this one out. Yeah, well, that's what I meant, the other infrastructure.
Well, we certainly will consider open space, parklands. That's part of the land use strategy. But we don't specifically speak about schools and the need for new schools and the like. That's not the focus of the work that we're doing.
True, but don't you think that that's a major element in most communities?
Yeah, it is. You know, one thing that we will probably have in the plan is a chapter at the end talking about advocacy, right? And the legislature, I think, did a good thing in passing SB 375 because they put two, I think, very important and related policy issues together, housing and transportation. But as your question is pointing out, there are a lot more that are very much related. You know, the state of the Oakland public school systems says a lot about whether we're going to have a successful infill strategy in Oakland, not just whether we can build houses somewhere. In my city where I live in San Francisco, they've got schools that they're not using. If we got more kids into the city, they could go into those schools. So, I mean, part of the infill PDA idea is you are trying to put more growth where there is a lot of existing infrastructure, not just transportation, but all of it, sewer, you name it. But in some of those places, you'll be stressing that infrastructure too, as you're pointing out. So, look, we can't address every issue under the sun in this plan. I think we do have in mind that as an evolution, Plan Bay Area will take on more and more of these subjects over time. But I'm guessing we're going to get to schools pretty late because, I mean, you've all been to school board meetings. That's a whole other world.
Yeah, I sat on a school board. That's why I'm asking the question. Okay.
But we absolutely understand there's other infrastructure, there's parks, there's all kinds of things that people need when they live somewhere. It's not just the house.
I agree. Okay, and the only other thing is don't take my BART from Livermore. BART. Yeah, the money can't go, you can't have that. Okay.
Okay, how about your light off? Rich, did you want to address something about schools in specific before I go to Kathleen?
It actually, a couple of these comments raised a question with me. I understand clearly that we're flying over this with this environmental, Bay Area environmental effort at about 30,000 feet. But one of the things that sort of concerned me that just popped up with the parks is that some of the developments that are very close to transit have required parks as large as, from the developers, 15 acres. Well, we have something set aside or some way to deal with the fact that the floor area ratio should not include those parks because that's going to kill very good developments that are transit oriented.
I think in terms of park land areas in its urban core, I mean, that's already built into the model. So if the city's general plan said these are areas of parklands, it's reflected in our model. Are you asking the question of would you be adding additional?
My question is much more specific. If you have a parcel that is a priority development area or is set up for transit-oriented development, and you want to get this exemption from the EIR, but you're going to require a developer to set aside a certain amount of it for parks, because with this added density, you're going to need more parks. Will that be included in the land area you have to figure the floor area ratio on?
Yes, it would. I mean, it basically means something. You're talking about higher. You're talking about different heights at that point.
Kathleen?
I was wondering under alternative number two, the policy measures to be determined under the land use side of things. Well, let me back up and start with my other question first. Under incentives, you list OBAG and CEQA streamlining, but I'm wondering why OBAG wouldn't just be applicable in all of these, since that's sort of a program that's in the transportation investment plan, and why isn't that being applied to all of them? Which I guess just sort of piggybacks on Egon's comments of why aren't we looking at applying the different urban SIM tools to all of the alternatives?
What we try to do is to take some of these different land use policies and apply them in different ways, in different packages. So we could certainly take a look at incentives, and OBAG, you're right, is pretty universal in terms of where its effects are with regards to PDAs, and we can certainly do that. What I try to do here is just to give you examples of what incentives might be, and OBAG is certainly one of them. But I take your point that if this is something that is applied at the regional level and has a universal effect on our prior development areas, and PDAs is a strategy for any one of those alternatives, we could certainly test that level of incentive within the alternative.
I would support that. My other question, yes, would be, I think this was already said, but also applying parking and VMTs under alternative three, sort of in the same vein of looking at what's available to us in terms of policies. And then my last question was, and this may be outside of what you're able to speak to today, but in terms of the regional prosperity plan, I know that it's coming along later than the EIR, but are some of the findings of that work going to be integrated into the policies? How are these projects going to be integrated?
In all likelihood, they won't. I think that work is largely going to get done after we adopt the plan next spring. So I think that work is going to parachute into Plan Bay Area 2, not Plan Bay Area 1.
Okay, thank you. And then my last question would be the rural PDAs or economic areas, will those, the final determination on those, will those be included?
I got to tell you, rural and economic PDAs, today's the first time I heard about any of that.
It was that horrible effort to try to classify coastside areas in, for example, San Mateo County as PDAs.
So we'll have to get back to you on that.
Thanks, Kathleen. Egon, and then Randy, and then Sandy.
I mean, I was just going to really quickly clarify. This was at the ABAG Regional Planning Committee last week, which I have the pleasure, fortunate to sit on. And the decision was made to eliminate the rural and employment ones as PDAs, but they're sort of called investment areas. So they're basically what it does now is they're eligible for OBAG money, but it's up to the counties now a little bit to distinguish between them. So they exist as places, but they've refined more what they're about, and there are no greenfield development allowed within them and some other changes. So they're there, but they're just eligible for some OBAG money.
Thank you. I just wanted to go back to the parks issue and the analytical tools again, because the tool's really good about saying, oh, here's where a building could go that would bring in, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 people. You put these buildings together and you get 10,000 people. Does it also say, by the way, according to your local ordinances and zoning requirements, you need to find this many acres of green space within? So does it have the capability of doing that?
Yes, if it's dictated in the zoning policies, we'll try to represent and simulate it in the model.
Okay. Good. Yeah, because I've seen the buildings pop up. I just haven't seen the accompanying green space.
There are specific policies in every general plan, as you know, about green space and parklands, and that's something that we hard code into the model. So in thinking about whether or not a developer builds a 5-story building or a 20-story building, all those other policies would still be in play.
Okay, thank you.
My question is about the process for public participation. So at the different meetings that you'll be going to and you're going to be getting public feedback, is there going to be a point where all of the feedback, including the written feedback, is going to be available for viewing and then the response or how it ended up being or not being in the EIR?
That's correct. What we'll do is we will collect all oral and written comments. We will summarize them, and we need to, for our purposes, go through each of them and decide which ones we can carry forward in the EIR process, whether it's alternatives or how we do our transportation analysis or whatever the case may be. We need to go through that process anyways, and so we'll be documenting that, and we can certainly make it available. It's something that we usually include as part of our draft document.
I thought I'd follow up just ever so quickly on the schools question is, how do we impact schools? I think the same can be said of schools impacting cities and jurisdictions, right? And that whether it's your K-12 or your community colleges or your four-year universities, they can expand and grow at their pleasure without actually informing some local jurisdictions, governmental jurisdictions. So I think it's, each entity, each governmental jurisdiction has to be a kind of aware and astute about what's happening around them, and hopefully those relationships are set up where that information is freely shared back and forth. But, they do every one of the entities go to business doing their own codes. So we've at least had those challenges in my arena. Okay. Any other comments or questions? All righty. Are there any motions out there or summary statements? Aegon?
I thought maybe if we could attempt to try to see if there's any motions of specific input to direct staff, since this is our kind of chance to weigh on it. It seems like a couple of us spoke, Linda and myself and others, about road pricing at least as something that ought to be tested. And so I'd like to kind of put together a motion that says we move that MTC staff study road pricing, particularly open lane tolling, as one of the policy tools within the EIR alternatives.
Okay. Can I?
Let me first see if I've got a second before we can even discuss it.
Second.
Okay. Seconded by Rich Hedges. Okay. Lori.
Okay, just a comment to staff in terms of how or would this hold up the EIR process in any way? And then if you consider pricing for under this, would it be for all the various components mentioned?
Don't know the answer to that one. Who did it? Must be me. Again, the more I think about it, the more I think it would make sense probably if we're going to apply these policy levers, whether it's pricing or something else, it'd probably make more sense to apply them across the board and see what it does as an additive to each of them instead of doing it to one, and then you're left to wonder, well, what could the other one have done?
Right.
So that's a provisional answer. Provisional, yes.
So you're saying you're able to give us pricing for all the components, then
sure.
We do that?
Okay. We can price anything you want us to.
Okay, well, I said...
Actually doing it's a different story, but we can model it.
Okay, well, I second you guys much.
Second squared. Okay, Rich?
Yeah, just to speak on the second, the reason of doing the second is that we've kicked this around a lot. I'm in favor of pricing, but I think we ought to know what it actually does. And I think that would maybe calm a lot of folks down if they knew that if we were doing the pricing, it actually had a positive benefit on traffic as well as on transit and infrastructure, that it would go down easier.
Let me ask the movers of this motion and the seconders, is this motion strictly in regards to road pricing, or do you want whatever other economics are taken into one scenario to be applied across the board, which it sounds like Steve is saying is probably the wiser application, at least.
I was going to answer that. I mean, I was actually going to make that as a second motion, because it seems like that's specific, a separate piece of input to provide. This was simply saying, study this one, not saying study it in scenario X, just study it. And then if we say study all policies across all of them, that would apply there.
Did I answer your question?
Do you want to include it in the first motion and then I'll second that? Or
I think they're different, yeah.
Okay, so unless there's any other discussion on the motion that's on the table in regard to road pricing. Question, Linda? Oh, okay, then all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? That motion passes unanimously. Egon?
And the second one, we don't have to make this a motion, but it feels it's just a little bit more formal to make it as a motion. It gets written down that way, that to make the EIR alternatives and the analysis clear for the public, clear for those of us on advisory councils and others, it seems like there's a way to test the policies and layer them on each other such that we know the individual impact of each of them, that we test a common set of policy variables across all of them. And when I say all of them, I think we're talking about 3, 4, and 5, right? We are not talking about alternatives 3, 4, and 5, not alternatives 1 and 2. Is that correct?
1 and 2 pretty much has to be reality today.
Yeah. Right.
You could test them, I suppose. I'm looking at Ashley. We're doing this as we're talking. You could layer some of those onto 2 and see how much better it could get, right?
We can go through an iterative process.
I'm thinking more of like sensitivity testing, I guess, is what I'm describing.
Yes, on the pricing stuff, we can certainly do that as a sensitivity test.
But can you do that with all of these little
building blocks? No, you can't. It's not that. Maybe 2 years from now, when the model is much more refined, we can go in that direction. But for now, the puzzle box, we do them as a group, and we can't isolate or extract out what zoning does versus what fees do. They're really combined together, and they interact together. But
so,
road pricing.
So what
could,
are the groups then? You're saying it's a group of 6 or groups of 2?
Groups of any combination within that area. So, like for example, we put zoning, incentives, and growth boundaries. That's one group, and they would be tested as
a
group.
And you can't disaggregate.
And I can't isolate out the impacts of growth boundaries.
But if you did, let's say, 3 pairs and you ran them across all the scenarios, you could compare the pairs to each other.
That's correct.
Got it. So I think we can get pretty close to what you're after. Maybe not 1-1-1-1-1, but we can distinguish.
And I think the key, so I don't know if we need to make it into a motion perhaps, because it's the idea of making it so that they're really easy and clear to distinguish between each other. You're really testing very different pieces.
So I think that's a direction to staff, and it sounds like we have staff input on that, so don't need a formal motion on that. And Kathleen, does that address your concern too on that? Okay, so then I'll go to your separate question.
Thank you. Sorry I didn't get to this earlier, but between alternatives 3 and 4, we say that alternative 4 is based on the network of transit neighborhoods land use pattern, but it shows some of the same policy options in terms of fees and growth boundaries. So would those then be layered again to further constrict? What's the iterative kind of thinking?
That's correct. It'd be layered again. So, like, for example, if we tested fees again, it'd be higher levels of development fees.
Got it.
And then urban growth boundaries, it would be more strict compliance with the urban growth boundaries.
Okay. And then thank you, that clarifies that. And then the only other, sorry, I didn't get to these earlier. In terms of number 5 with the land use, in providing more affordable and high housing and high jobs accessibility locations, would that be using in the 6 Winds Network and sort of that proposal that they submitted in the white paper about the methodology for assigning assigning housing to those areas with low-income commuters. Will we be getting a report of, like, what's the methodology? Will that be the methodology used for that? Just I'd like some more transparency about that.
Right. We just received that paper just earlier this week about one idea that was, I think, advanced by UC Davis. I think we're going to do something different using our model because that's not the way that we I don't know whether or not we can replicate that methodology. I think the approach we're taking is going to be very policy-based approach, and we'll try to do it consistently across the scenarios. So we're not really using the model to manipulate things. We're using the model by way of applying policies. So if there's a set of policy measures that mimic what maybe that paper suggests, we'll try to test it in that fashion. But I can't tell you with certainty now. Just received the paper. I didn't read it in full.
Thank you.
I think it is worth mentioning that with this fifth idea up here, it is an idea that has been proposed by an outside collection of interests, right? And so I have a feeling that the way we're going to evaluate it is going to involve some negotiation between us and them. Because, look, we don't want to change their idea entirely because then they'll say, well, you didn't look at my idea. But we have to make sure that it's playing by the same rules as the others. The other thing to mention for those of you who weren't at the meeting is that at the planning committee meeting, the business community was sort of saying, me too. You know, if you're going to look at theirs, we've got one for you to look at too. And so I think there may be a push in this scoping process for them to coalesce around an idea, probably a different idea from number five, but an idea that I would expect would be a lot less PDA-oriented than the one we've adopted so far as our preferred.
Thank you.
Okay, the only other comment I think I want to make, Ashley, is to loop back around to this question of whether there should be a fifth meeting in the Solano County area. And I personally feel strongly that there should be some kind of a meeting. I don't know if you want to call it a scoping meeting. And I don't live in that area, so I don't even know who the entities are in that area, except maybe Commissioner Spearing, who you might be able to coordinate a meeting with. But I do feel strongly about that. And just by saying that, I have at least two other people who feel equally as strongly about something I've just said. So I'm going to call on Rich Burnett and then Rich Hedges.
Right. Yeah. Lori and myself will agree. I think the North Bay Area, that part of the North Bay Area, Solano County, I think we deserve at least something there. There is, from my reading of the local situation, there is a growing interest among the populace in the Plan Bay Area and, you know, what, and the EIR here. So, there's a natural interest with the planning department, but I think among some of the locals, the interest is developing, whether it's the Vallejo area or the Fairfield area or the Vacaville area. So I would encourage that, you know, if it is possible, to try to schedule something up there.
I think we were responding to Rodrigo's comment about Rossmore, and that's in Contra Costa County, I believe.
Yeah, but that's on the other side of the hill where Dublin, Livermore, and Pleasanton are, too.
Well, yeah, but if you're talking about a fifth meeting somewhere and you were responding, yeah, I just mentioned that he lives in Contra Costa County.
I think in general, in relation to all of the meetings, I mean, speaking for myself, I was a local planning commissioner, and I found this presentation somewhat confusing, and still I still don't quite have my head around it. What would be in this EIR, what would be excluded from a local perspective, and I think it's going to be really confusing for the general public. And so that at the same time that I think there needs to be more public participation, I also think it's going to be extremely confusing and potentially, I mean, communities are very, every time, you know, there's an EIR process and there's scoping processes, people come ready to fight because they're concerned about what's in it, and it's very confusing as to what it is that's actually, that we're even talking about in the scoping process. So, I think that's something that needs some further thought, personally.
have Lori and then Federico.
Okay, I'm going to make this really quick. Dolly, thank you for bringing this up again before we adjourn, because I think it is very imperative that we do have some type of scoping meeting out in the Sonoma County area, only because it's more challenging for those who live in Fairfield area and Vallejo area to get over to the Marin area. And I just think it's fair to cover the North Bay area. Okay. And again, one approach that I mentioned earlier is that if it's really impossible for you to have a meeting over there, I think what would suffice is that you could work with city staff, maybe the county as well, and having them to place on their websites this meeting or maybe some other tool that they could use to inform others that of where these meetings are held, because I didn't, it would be difficult for me to know. But I would prefer that there be a meeting held out there.
Federica?
Let me say that as a resident of Contra Costa County, I recognize every area has its own uniquenesses. However, I would strongly support a scoping meeting within Vallejo, Solano area, because I think outside this hard urban core area where we have the current established scoping meetings, I think many of the same issues and concerns that we might have in Contra Costa would also be germane and voiced out in Vallejo. I would like to strongly encourage staff to look at that.
So, do you think we can do this, Ashley?
Let me answer.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
We've heard you loud and clear. Why don't we check in with Commissioner Sparing, and if he concurs, we'll do the fifth meeting.
All right. Thank you for working on that. I appreciate it, Randy.
I just wanted to circle back to my issue of project versus building. And how we're going to address that somewhere down the line, because it's a flaw in SB 375 from my point of view that we're shackled with this. So how do we address it? How do we address that going forward? Because my community designs, if we got 10 acres, we split it up not building by building as a 75-25 cut, I'm back on the original slide six, I think. So how do we address that?
Well, I have a proposal. We could put it in the form of a motion, but it's really, in my mind, this would be a suggestion or recommendation to MTC to include in their legislative package program planning modifications to SB 375 in the future, in particular the provision that a transit priority project must be 50% residential. We talked about this earlier. I think it was most people, and we've had this discussion in this room as well, most people, when they think of smart growth and transit-oriented development, historically have talked about housing. And we need to be thinking much more about employment. And so I believe that is why the drafters of the bill had in their minds TOD as housing. That's why it's in there. Quite simply, or I think that's sort of the very nature of it. In addition to the fact that you need a hook or a lever to encourage jurisdictions to put housing much more so than to plan for jobs. But I think it's an appropriate modification to SB 375 that would acknowledge truly what motivates people to take transit more. So I think that would be the appropriate venue, would be for MTC to include it in there. But I don't know if we have a quorum anymore to make a motion.
I don't think
yeah.
so.
But it's something we could take up in the future or in looking at your legislative sort of it's like in the implementation of Plan Bay Area.
You know, before we get there, because I think pity the fool who tries to amend SB 375. It took 2 years to pass it. I think what we ought to do for you is give you a little bit better briefing of the detail of that part of the law, because, you know, this thing that I think got a lot of you agitated. The list of exemption criteria is as long as your arm. And we've got a good attorney on retainer who helped write this bill. So let's make sure we really have problems before we go try to fix them.
Okay. Well, I disagree to a certain extent, Stephen, this, because I think that this is something where the the framing of the logic of TOD is sort of embedded in SB 375, similar to the MTC Resolution 3434 that has a pure housing focus. I think this is an important distinction that's beyond just the specifics of the law.
It may well be, but again, I think it'd be better to have a good base of knowledge on exactly what the law says first, maybe have a little workshop before you all, and then you can start thinking up your list of improvements.
All right, we'll take it up in the future. Any other comments on this item? Thanks again, Ashley, for bringing us this update and taking our suggestions and comments into the next step and in future steps. Let's come back to item then, or fast forward. We didn't have any public comment on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Item number 8, council member reports. Randy?
AB 57 has crossed another hurdle for those of us who want representation for San Jose and Oakland, and it cleared the Transportation Committee with flying colors. So one step.
Great. Kathleen?
As a future agenda item, I'd like to request a discussion and an update on the Regional Prosperity Plan and consideration for a Policy Advisory Council member to have a position on either the Joint Projects Committee or the Steering Committee.
Any others? All right. And that actually flowed nicely into item number 9, new business for the committee to consider. So there you go. With that, then I adjourn the meeting today, and we'll see you July 11th. Thank you.